This episode of See Here is brought to you by two naive kids from Moose Jaw.
Morning, good evening, good afternoon, and it's good night from him. You're listening to the See Here podcast. My name is Morris. On the other end of a Skype connection, we have Mr. Bernard Stickwell from Bath.
Hello.
And in Seoul, in Korea, we have Mr. Tim Merrill. Good evening, Tim.
BIM is the power, BIM is the word.
And over in Chicago, Ms. Wendy, I love the apple.
Hey, friends.
Now, I should also be introducing one more person to this mix. We were going to have a special guest to come and discuss today's movie, The Apple, with us. And this was something that, you know, he suggested and went along with Mr. Justin Oberholzer, the Cinemasochist, who is widely known to many of you in the community. Unfortunately, because of work commitments, he's had to back out. But champion that he is, Justin has sent an MP3 of a bit of a spiel he gives about the film, what his thoughts are on the film, and I'll be playing that later on in the show for your enjoyment and edification, and he has some very, very interesting things to say about it. So look for that later on the show, but right now it's going to be the four of us discussing the 1980 film made by the Canon Film Studio, directed by Menachem Golan, called The Apple. So I want to go around the table and maybe I should give a bit of a synopsis first before we go around the table. So this is off IMDb. Alfie and Bibi, two sweet, naive youths from Moose Jaw, Canada, have come to America to compete in the 1994 World Vision Song Festival. Although the pair have talent, they are beaten out by the underhanded tactics of the festival favorites, another duo with the backing of BIM, Boogaloo International Music, and its leader, Mr. Boogaloo. Though crestfallen by their loss, Bibi and Alfie are soon delighted to hear that Mr. Oh, this is too long, too much shit. Anyway, so they sign up with Mr. Boogaloo, who's the head of a big music corporation called BIM. They basically see what the rock and roll life is all about, and in fact that the rock and roll life is run by Satan. I don't think I've given away too much there.
Hang on a moment.
The hell you say?
In 1994, the world is controlled by one power. Apple is success.
There ain't no pride, there ain't no shame, there ain't no sympathy, there ain't no blame, there ain't no pleasure, there ain't
the
no
Apple
pain.
Brings you everything.
What about happiness?
I wanted to release Bibi from a contract.
Cheers.
Where is she?
I stand alone. I stand alone. Cry for me.
The apple is the temptation.
Taste it. Taste it.
The apple is the experience.
Take the apple. Whoa. Where's the apple?
apple is the forbidden fruit.
Come and take me and shake me and mold me and make me and fill me up with your fire. Come do anything to me. Your little heart desires.
Ooh, I've never been so high in my life.
The apple takes your soul.
New York out to L.A. Everybody does it her way. Pumping power by the hour. Speed. I can feel the earth start quaking when America starts shaking. Pumping power by the hour. Speed. Speed.
Now, a special experience in movie-going entertainment. The Apple.
So, anyway, before we go into further story and plot contrivances, let's go around the table. Now, Bernie, you watched this very recently. What were your initial thoughts?
I think the first thing that popped into my head, and I would put money on the fact that this is what you all thought as well the first time you saw it, is what the fuck? I mean, literally, how did this get made? How did so much money get spent on it? What the fuck was everybody thinking? It's just, I don't know, words can't really kind of do it justice. It's, I suppose, you know, it's a car crash, essentially, and you kind of have to see it to believe it. Yeah, what the fuck?
Mr. Tim, did you have a moment? Because I think you saw this quite a while ago, didn't you?
Oh, a long time ago, in the 80s. I mean, there used to be, I think there still is a TV station in the United States, CBS. And they used to have Friday night CBS late night. I remember coming home one night after being out on the town getting snapped. And, I'm laying there in a haze on the couch. And I turn on the TV and I see this singing and dancing. And it kind of reminded me of when I was a kid in the 70s, they had these two brothers in the United States, Sid and Marty Croft.
Oh, yes. And the H.R. Puff and stuff.
H.R. Puff and stuff, right. And the Croft brothers also did some.
The Splits are a better band than this.
Yeah, and they did. But the Croft brothers did live action, too, with singing and dancing. And there was Captain Cool and the Kongs. Like, there was some really, really bad, like, live-action music stuff that the Croft brothers did in the 70s. And I watched this film, and it reminded me of that. It reminded me of the Osmonds, for some reason, like Donnie and Marie.
Funny you say that, Tim. On IMDb, where it says people who like this also like, they've got Going Bananas, which is the
the Donnie and Marie movie. Yeah. Wow, that's funny. And also, initially, watching this again, I don't know. Did you get a feeling, Bernie? Like, you've seen Holy Mountain, right?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Tim, I think incredibly generous making that comparison.
Some of this, no. No, I mean, like, okay, for example, okay, I don't mean to go ahead here, but there's a scene when they're waiting to see Mr. Boogaloo and they're in the lobby and they're talking to a guy who's like the manager of an opera or a ballet troupe. People blowing fire and there's a little midget guy and there's all this. Like, that's like the type of weird shit that Jodorowsky just – you know, he dwells in that. He loves that kind of stuff. You know, that kind of, you know, like Fellini-esque.
Exactly, yeah.
But I know it's not the same. Of course not.
Good. All right.
I mean, like, compare.
Well, I was going to be slightly sacrilegious a little bit later on in mentioning this, but as long as we're talking about it now, I didn't think so much Jodorowsky, but I sort of thought that Menachem Golan had watched a Federico Fellini film. And
right.
He knew how to do it pretty much in the same way that Ed Wood thought that he was Orson Welles.
Right. Yeah, that's a good comparison. I can see that. Yeah. Although I don't know whether he would have watched the Fellini film. He might have just heard about one once.
Right.
So, Wendy, your first thoughts?
Excuse me.
Hang on, you didn't tell me that Dr. Zom is in the room with you.
I'm a girl, I can't make fart noises very well, but that was my thoughts.
Okay. Well, I don't think we can get much out of you for the rest of the show. Shit, I mean, come on, you can articulate a little bit more than that.
Yeah. Oh man, it's
brutal.
This is just rough. It's so funny. It's like it was like everything that I hate about 70s camp, like cranked up to 11. It was.
Which itself is already like a film reference. So you don't like Spinal Tap either.
No, Spinal Tap is awesome. Spinal Tap is hilarious. That's not like weird. I don't know. I'm saying like things like obviously like you guys know I didn't like Phantom of the Paradise and I don't like Rocky Horror Picture Show and I don't know. I just don't like these weird sort of disco-y over the top things like that. I don't know, man.
Wendy, and next up on C here is Can't Stop the Music.
Oh, Wendy, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you like fun, Wendy?
No. Keep that fun away from me.
Apparently not. Okay, fine. You know, I just wanted to clarify.
I was going to say,
I don't like anything that involves people with glitter on their faces or weird, or weird face makeup. I don't know why that weirds me out. I don't like that at all.
So you never liked the Sweet or Slade or any T-Rex or any of that stuff in the 70s?
No, I do, but I'm talking about like weird movie musical stuff.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
well, I mean, you know what?
That'd be sacrilege not to like them.
The one thing I want to say is I want to be the contrarian here because usually we always have one contrarian out of the four of us, but I want to say that first off, you know, not to make a confession, but I don't give a shit. I love this movie. I think it's awesome.
Okay, so my question to you, Tim, is do you love this movie because you love it, or do you love this movie because it's so in that so bad it's good sort of way?
A little bit of both, because I think on one hand, you know, the film is just trying to do its thing, and it's trying to kind of, you know, grasp at so many elements, too many elements, you know what I mean? It's like Golem was trying to basically, you know, line up all these ducks in a row when, you know, I mean, he couldn't even hit the broadside of a barn with a fucking machine gun, you know. And but the truth of the matter is, though, there's just something fun about it. Like Bernie said, it's just goofy. And it's, you know, and of course it's bad. But I just think it's, you know, sometimes, you know. You want, like, I mean, of course, you know, I'm going to sit down and watch Citizen Kane, or I'll watch, you know, like The Godfather or serious films, you know, that nature. But once in a while, you just want to eat macaroni and cheese. You know what I mean? And it's like once in a while, it's just there's something that you want to watch and it's just so goofy.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just a real honest goofiness about this film that I like. You know, it's just silly.
I mean, look, okay, so I'm with the majority in saying that this film is a car wreck, and actually I felt like chest pains. I'm shit you not. I felt chest pains while watching this, and I can't say that about any other bad movie that I've watched. However, there are some things that I have taken into account, and one thing that I will say is not necessarily as a positive for the film, but that it doesn't go down to the bottom of the pile, is I remember back, I think it was in 1980, going to the opening weekend of what was then a new cinema in Melbourne, and it's unfortunately now closed down about a year or two ago. But on this opening weekend, they showed the biggest abomination of a film ever that I was really excited to see, and it was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band with the Bee Gees and Peter fucking Frampton. Now, one thing I will say about The Apple, unlike Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, The Apple is not boring. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band committed what I thought is the biggest cardinal sin that a film can ever do, and that was bore you to tears. That was just – it was – the songs were sung terribly. I think only Earth, Wind & Fire came out with any redemption. It was an abomination. It was terrible, and The Apple is above that, okay? I will give it that. And also that I'll say where – I feel that the apple in some ways is like shooting fish in a barrel, to criticize it. I was listening, as I think I mentioned to you guys, to an episode of The Projection Booth from, I'm not sure, maybe a year or two ago. And they were not only talking about the apple, but they interviewed quite a number of the people who are associated with it. So there was the songwriters and original writers of the stage play, Corby and Iris Recht. And the original stage play was written in Hebrew, written for the Israeli stage. And then they took it to Menachem Golan, who said, okay, I think we'd do better with this on an international stage as a film if we redid it in English. So they got someone else whose name I've forgotten, and I really should have those notes in front of me, who helped them sort of shape it, put it into shape into English. But according in the interview to Corby and Iris Recht, they reckon that Menachem Golan basically changed a lot of what their original script was. That's not to say that what they originally came up with would have been much better than this, but to be fair, listening to a lot of this interview, everyone who they spoke with, Catherine Mary Stewart, who plays the main actress, or the main one of the main characters in the film, Bibi, and Corby and Iris Recht themselves. And they even spoke to Menachem Golan. So this must have been about 2-3 years ago, because I think he only died, was it in the last 12 months or something like that, I think. Every one of them put their heart and soul into this. I mean, you look at it and you think, it's an abomination. Oh, my goodness, what did they do? To be fair, and I'm a little bit even-handed, it's not because it was bad from a technical perspective. We don't see, at least I didn't pick up anything in the way of continuity errors. They obviously worked hard on the choreography, whether or not you like it, but they worked hard on it. And, you know, the musical numbers, everything is big. It's tasteless, and it offends me, but it's big. And they obviously put a lot of heart and soul into it, and I go so far as to say I respect it. I don't like it, but I respect it.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say, you know, is that this idea that, you know, that I always have a belief that no matter how shitty things are, people really put an effort. If people have put an effort behind it, then, you know, you really can't, you know, you got to give them that. And I mean, you know, if the people that made the apple just kind of went, eh, it's a movie, I'm getting paid $2 an hour to do this film, I could give a shit, you know.
There was no one check cashing in this film.
No, there wasn't. Yeah. And that's the thing is, I mean, you know, and that's what really, you know, makes it all the worse is that, you know, you're looking at these people really believing that they're going to make something fantastic. You know, that they're coming off with, they think that, you know, they're really onto something. And then you're looking going, yeah, they must have been on something, not onto something.
There's a lot of blow on the set of this film, I imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Oh, my God, there must have been. Jesus.
Yeah, similarly, I just watched that documentary about Ken, and I just watched Electric Boogaloo. And yeah, like it's true. Like it seems like he really wanted this to be such a great thing. Like he really did put all of his heart and soul into the idea of this movie.
I don't know if they mentioned this in the documentary. I haven't had a chance to see it yet. But in the projection booth, and they interviewed Menachem Golan, and I found this really very chilling, very upsetting. But he said that because of the initial reaction to the film, I think at its premiere, he strongly contemplated suicide. Did they talk about that in the film?
No, that's sad, though.
No, apparently after the critic screening at Cannes, or was it Cannes? It was somewhere.
I think it might have been Cannes, yeah.
He went back to his hotel, and apparently he was, again, whether this is actually true or not, this might be him just spinning his own myth a little more, who knows.
Maybe.
He was on the balcony ready to jump, and is it Golan, his partner? He came in and sort of talked him down, apparently.
Yeah.
So, Jesus. Well, you know what's really funny, too, is like, you know, everybody looks at, you know, Masters of the Universe, and they're like, holy shit, was that ever a chunk of cheese? And I'm like, au contraire, my friend, you have no idea. You have no idea. You know, it's like Golden Globus, they've gone far below Masters of the Universe, you know.
And I just, I want to say one more thing about Golan and in relation to what he could do with a musical. So back in 1973 or 74, there was a film that was made called Casablanca. And I remember seeing this as a kid. And they actually filmed it twice, once in English and once in Hebrew. They didn't overdub it. So the English version I can't find anywhere, but I have the Hebrew version, and it's still it's actually a really good musical. I'm not saying it's a five-star film by any stretch of the imagination, but it was sort of like a modern take on West Side Story, but without any of the tragedy, I guess. But it was, you know, a guy from the wrong side of the track starring probably the world's oldest gang leader. But it had heart, and the songs were really good. And it's just a good film. So Golan actually showed that with the right material, he could actually come up the goods with, you know, what was a good musical. So, and I guess before we sort of like go into more in depth in the film, I also wanted to sort of go around the table and ask about your feelings about musicals. So I know that there are a lot of people like on the Gentleman's Guide and other forums who say, I don't like musicals. I don't like musicals. And I've got to say, as someone actually, I mean, because I grew up, you know, watching West Side Story and My Fair Lady and all those sorts of things. You know, it was popular in my family. I watched all those films. So I've grown up with those musicals, and I know that there are some musicals that are turds. I don't have a problem with the notion that someone can just burst out into song instead of dialogue in a film. And they say, oh, well, that, you know, that's really goofy. But when you think about it, how much do we suspend disbelief in all sorts of films? So it's just you immerse yourself in that world. You might not find all the songs great. You might not even find a particular film great. But the whole notion of a musical being bad just because in real life people don't burst out into song. Well, but, you know, all sorts of things happen in films that don't happen in real life. But, you know, we roll with punches with that. So I just wanted to say my problem with The Apple is not because it's a musical. It's because it's a dumb musical. But anyway, so that's my thought. The round the table, were you guys fans of musicals? And I don't mean musicals like where, hey, let's get on and put on a show. I mean, I have something to say to you, but I'm going to sing it to you instead type of musical. What do you guys think?
I think musicals are just a genre like any other. You know, like you can't be across the board like, oh, I hate all Westerns, or, oh, I hate all crime films, I hate all whatever. There's always going to be something that's good and something that's bad. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's a lot of, I mean, I love, like, Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff, and I love, you know, like, classic kind of things. There's a lot of modern musicals that I think are absolute crap, you know, but it's just another genre like anything else. There's good and there's bad, and the stuff that's good is really good. But, yeah, you're right, exactly. It's just another form of narrative. It's just another form of suspending your disbelief, you know, but I take it by who's writing the music more than anything else.
Right. Tim?
I was going to say there was that the film that was directed by, what's his name now? Shit. The Coen brothers, Barton Fink, what was his name? John Turturro just did a film a while back where all the dialogue was a musical.
Oh, really? What was that?
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I love Turturro.
Oh, he did a film where all the dialogue was everybody singing in it. I'm at a loss right now. I apologize for not knowing the title, but you talked about people just breaking into song. You know, mm-hmm. how that doesn't normally happen, and you know, and again, it's this whole thing where you know some musicals are really on point, and you know how they really work within a format or within a scenario, they're really effective. Like, for example, you know, Rocky Horror is a take on all the 50s B-movies and everything, so it all takes place in a castle, and it's all camp, so, I mean, it all works, or, you know, how Phantom takes place in a theater, and it all works within the confines of a theater and a production, you know, I mean, but this whole idea of just breaking in the song, you know, that just doesn't normally happen, you know.
But once again, when you walk into the theater and you know that you're going to be seeing a film, and right, this is the world that we're creating, and in this world, people do burst out into song. Okay, accept that notion, right? Then it's no longer ridiculous. And as I said, I don't take very kindly to that argument that says I can't watch a musical because I don't understand people breaking out into song. Because you know, we all go and accept all sorts of cinematic tropes. That just
accept half the cars that blow up in movies or you know, like this.
And no one gets hurt.
Right.
Bernie.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I have no problem with musicals at all. As with any genre, like Wendy said, there's good and there's bad. You've got to judge each film on its own merits, haven't you? So, but I certainly I have no problem with musicals. I think the big problem with The Apple, which nobody's really mentioned yet, is two things, really. First of all, the songs are generally pretty fucking bad.
Yes.
Oh, God!
And also the script, or maybe not so much the script, but the dialogue is just absolutely fucking painful. People sort of talk in these bizarre sort
script?
Of... Well, exactly. I mean, it gets from sort of A to D to H to B to F. Do you know what I mean? It just... And also, the ending makes no fucking sense, because you know the story about why that makes no sense, yeah?
Please tell us.
Well, it would apparently... I don't know. Should we spoil it for people out there?
I think we should spoil it, but I think we should sort of like work our way up to spoiling it, Bernie, don't you think? Oh, well, but, you know, look, go for it. Go for it.
Well, we'll get to the ending a bit later, perhaps, but there's a fairly important scene which was filmed initially, which apparently went completely tits up and people were actually injured. So they didn't put that bit in the film. And because of that, that was the prologue for the movie. Because of that, the ending... literally makes no sense at all.
Okay.
So, right.
But
it was the film I was going to talk about. I was talking about with Turturro. It was called Romance and Cigarettes, by the way.
Didn't get a cinema release here, and I haven't sort of heard about it through any other formats. Did you say you'd seen this?
Yeah, it was quite the cast. It's got James Gandolfini, Susan Sarandon, Kate Winslet, Steve Buscemi, Christopher Walken, Eddie Izzard.
Wow, that is a cast.
Yeah, it's got and everybody's singing. The whole film is all singing.
So they possibly would have taken their a cue from a film like Umbrellas of Cherbourg or something like that, because there's
right.
So let's actually talk a little bit about the film itself. Now, I know that it seems like Tim, you've gone and professed your love for it. The rest of us have not, but it seems like in listening to the podcast, the projection booth, and also sort of reading around some of the other reviews online, it seems that there are a lot of people who are saying, you know what, yeah, it's bad, but there's a lot of wonderful stuff about it. And I guess none of us sort of, well, except for yourself, Tim, and also notwithstanding my respect for the people who sort of work so hard for it, but as a film, it's three of us still find it to be a bit of a turd. And when you sort of like look at it on paper, if you sort of don't read the story, but you sort of think that the themes here, we get shades of 1984 mixed in with elements of the Torah and the New Testament, Phantom of the Paradise, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, Time Bandits at the end, elements of Hair, Jesus Christ Superstar, and another turd of a film, Shock Treatment. And really, there's a lot in there, and you think, well, yeah, this could go either way. This could be great or this could be a disaster. And well, in the end, it turned out to be a disaster. And I think for all of that, though, still may be an interesting disaster. But
it's a blender drink. That's what I'd like to refer to it as. It's a blender drink.
Yeah.
You know, it's a mix, like you say, a mix of everything, you know.
Yeah.
But there's some things that just make me laugh at this movie, and it's just, and I mean, laugh at just things that come out of nowhere. Like, I mean, like, for example, let's start at the beginning. You know, you've got the BIM band at this contest, you know, the World Music Festival. And then you've got Alfie, I mean, what are they called?
Handy and Dandy.
Andy and Dandy, right. And they're, you know, and they're basically, you know, the ringers. They're, you know, they're destined to win. And then you got Alfie and Bebe that come in, and they're almost like, you know, it reminded me of almost like Donnie and Marie. Like, they're just the wholesome, and they're coming all across as two Canadians from Moose Jaw. it's like the middle of nowhere. Like, you know, it's like, I laugh my ass off, because even in Canada, that would be hilarious, right? It would be like, you know, imagine, you know, Morris, a film was done in India, like a Bollywood film, and they say, hello, we are from St. Kilda. You know, like it's just, where? You know, it's like you wouldn't, you just, you know, unless you know, you don't know, right? But I think it's funny in the beginning where, you know, it's like they're actually gauging the audience, you know, heart rate and the audience, you know, anticipation and their anxiety, and they're cheering and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, when, you know, BB and her partner really start to grab the audience, and then it's like, you know, Mr. Boogler says, pop in this little tape. He's like, what? He gives it to his henchman, who I should say is totally ripped off years later in The Fifth Element.
Yeah, I thought that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And but then when he gives his henchman the tape, and he tells his henchman to tell the guy, you know, play this tape. What if somebody sees me put it in? Then you'll die. You know, so of course the guy starts to play Rattle and Hum. So, you know, so he starts playing that over top of, you know, Alfie and BB, and then the audience starts throwing up spontaneously, as I would too, having a here fucking boner. But anyway, then they can't understand what's going on. So then all of a sudden it's like, you know, they leave, and, you know, Alfie's just like, holy shit, man, like, we suck, we're terrible. The BB's just, now we got invited to the party. Let's go. You know? And then off they go. And then and it's like, and then Mr. Boogaloo, who I should say to anyone who's never seen this film, let's get into Mr. Boogaloo. To me, Mr. Boogaloo was like the rancid hell spawn of like Vincent Gallo and Judd Hirsch. he just had this weird one earring guy. You couldn't tell whether he looked Polish or Romanian or...
Well, actually, I did a little bit of research about the actor, whose name was Vladek Shadal. And he has actually quite an interesting background before. So he didn't just sort of like arrive on the set of The Apple as someone who, you know, just needed to, who had an accent, who they were going to get to fill the role. He actually is Polish, and according to IMDb, he'd actually been a member of the Polish underground, had been in Nazi work camps twice and escaped both times during the war. So, you know, he was part of the, as I said, Polish underground resistance. When he finally got out after the war, he didn't know, right, do I go off and do medicine or do I go off and do acting? And he decided he'd go off and do acting. So he was actually at Sean Connery's insistence, he was in From Russia with Love. And
yeah,
before that, he'd actually trod the stage with Roman Polanski. So we're not just talking about any old hack.
Wow.
So
wow.
There you go. So in the shit, you find the nuggets.
Yeah. Like, but it, you know, but anyways, he invites, you know, Alfie and BB in, and, you know, as the snake, the proverbial snake in the garden. And next thing you know, it's like he's hustling BB off with his boy, and he's trying to hook Alfie up with his girl, you know?
Right, so let's talk a little bit about that. They go and so basically what happens is BB goes and starts singing this song with I can't remember which is Pandy or is Dandy.
Dandy
the male,
is the guy, yeah.
Yeah,
Dandy is the guy. All right, now Dandy, and tell me, Bernie, do you reckon that he looks a bit like? Oh, sorry, when he sings, he sounds a bit like David Essex.
Absolutely,
looks like Roger Daltrey.
I was going to say, totally David Essex. Yeah.
David Essex's voice and Roger Daltrey's looks.
That's right.
Right.
He even does a lot, and Wendy, you'd appreciate this a lot with his open chest. You know, the bare top. You know, I mean, he's not quite George Eastman, but you know.
I do appreciate it.
Well, you found one thing you like about the film. It's excellent. So,
do you know Alan Love? So anyway, Alan Love, who plays Pandy, he's only in. Yeah. He's got 5 credits as an actor. That's it. He's only been in 5 things.
So he has something in common with John Cazale, then.
I guess right. So.
Yeah,
my film.
He's the anti-Cazale.
Oh my god!
Right, the anti-Cazale, because I mean, at least Cazale has done 5 fantastic films where this guy can't say.
I was trying to sort of make it positive for him, but
he's in Gregory's Girl, so he's done one fantastic.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh my God! Oh, well, and Gregory's Girl is one of my favorite films of all time.
Yeah, how could you not spot that, Morris? Jeez.
I have no idea where he was. Oh my
right.
God! So, all right. So anyway, so the point I was going to make. So Dandy goes off with BB, and like basically he's cheated at beating her at this big music competition, which there were only two acts in the whole competition. Next thing she knows, so she should be feeling resentful, and she's at this party, and you know she's with her boyfriend, and what does she do? She goes off with this guy who says, right, you're going to be my girlfriend, and she says, I've got these stirrings in my loins. I want to play tonsil hockey with you.
Ah, he does drug her first, though, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Is that a common thing? You take like an upper, and all of a sudden you want to you know, it wasn't just a matter that she wanted to root him. But it was a matter that she thought, I love you. I want to.
He basically roofied her, is what he did.
Yes.
He gets ecstasy or something. Molly.
Yeah, he roofied her. But, you know, I was going to say the guy who plays Alfie, what's really funny is, you know, they're both supposed to come off as Canadians. And meanwhile, he's got an accent that I really couldn't put my finger on. And finally, I figured it out.
Isn't he Irish?
He's Scottish.
Oh, Scottish. Okay.
He's Scottish. He's Scottish, yeah.
Well, if he was in Gregory's Girl, then that would make sense.
No. That Alan Scottish, Love was yeah. Pandy. Are you talking
that
about
that was the
Alfie?
Other guy.
Oh,
Pandy,
right.
The main
guy. Sorry.
Talking about Alfie. Because initially, I'm thinking he was in Australia.
Well, he couldn't top this.
He was in a Scottish rock group called the Bow Weevils.
Oh, I know the Bow Weevils.
Bow Weevils, huh?
Wow. But this is the only thing he ever starred in. Well. Did you all notice that Alfie, George Gilmore, he wore the same pair of jeans throughout the whole film, and they were really tight. He had some serious moose knuckle going on. Did you notice that?
Oh, yeah.
Really, really tight.
Oh, he wasn't wearing any jeans in the Garden of Eden scene.
No, he wasn't at the end, but up until that point, he was...
I'm not talking about the end. I'm talking about the descent into hell.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course.
Take a bite of the apple. He's not wearing
anything
there. And oh, my God. So I got it while we're sort of in that scene. And before, Bernie, you were mentioning about the wonderful lyrics that were written for this film.
Oh, I've got one here. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I bet it's the same one I have. Go on, read it out.
It's a natural desire meets a real vampire.
It's a natural, natural, natural desire meet an actual, actual, actual vampire.
There you go. And the only just because it rhymes, it doesn't make any sense in the context of the scene. Do you know what I mean? It's not
correct.
It's just like desire and vampire rhyme. That'll work. Let's do that. And then some chick with fangs sort of jumps up on the screen and makes sort of hissy vampire noises.
Right, and you know what's really funny too that I really thought was hilarious was when you know they hit the point of where they're supposed to sign a contract, and then you know Alfie's really hesitant, you know, and all of a sudden he starts getting the visions, and you know, and the next thing you know they're in hell, and then I expected to see the Blues Brothers come out. Because there's that, you know, I expect to see the Blues Brothers come out.
Another thing about the songs in this movie, they are so derivative of other songs from that period and other musicals. Yeah. There's not an original as far as the music goes.
Oh, no.
I was going to say, they obviously said that they wanted to have... they wanted to touch on every genre, so they do a bit of reggae.
Oh,
and
that one is terrible. How to Be a Master.
As opposed to the good ones? Which ones were good?
Particularly bad, that one. Oh, well, yeah, it's like you say. There's a disco-ish song a bit later on. It's called I'm Coming For You, and I think there was some kind of subtext to that song. I couldn't quite grasp it. But... That's, and then that, there was that, that the, totally lifts from I Feel Love by Donna Summer, doesn't it? There's just an extended.
I disagree because I Feel Love is actually a good song.
Oh, well, of course, yeah. But I'm still scratching my head about that particular song. I'm not quite sure what they were getting at there.
Are you suggesting, Bernie, that Coming For You has a touch of the Giorgio Moroder?
Just a little touch, yes.
Okay.
Yes. But did you not think
that? I was
going to
say they had
that
whole, what was it, the cruising tribute, too.
Yeah.
That was great, you know.
Speed.
We all need speed. We all need speed. Oh. Yeah. Woo.
Isn't there a scene in that where... BB, Catherine Mary Stewart, she's working out in a sort of gym, but she's wearing leather shorts. You wouldn't want leather shorts when you're in the gym, would you?
Now, you guys tell me that she was wrong. That years later, Britney Spears had not watched this film and taken influence. It's her whole career.
God, well, Miley Cyrus, jeez.
Well, I mean, all of them. I mean, shit, man. You look at Lady Gaga, you could see her taking fashion tips from this film, and I mean... Miley, like, oh, yeah, all of them. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, you know?
We haven't even gone to the plot of the whole fascism of the BIM industry and the stupid stickers you had to wear on your face.
The BIM stickers, yeah.
I have to say that made me feel very uncomfortable, that whole BIM sticker. But, of course, in the end, all he had to do was rip it off.
Yeah.
But
well, come on, Morris, you're not wearing your BIM sticker?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm wearing mine.
Really? Oh, okay.
There's that scene where Miriam Margulies gets hassled in the street and given a ticket for not wearing her BIM sticker.
Right.
And then she goes back to the apartment house, which she owns and Alfie lives in, and he grabs her tits. Did you notice that?
I was going to say, well, Menachem Golan probably went up to George Gilmore and said, listen, in this next scene, I want you to grab her tits because, face it, you're not getting Catherine Mary Stewart at any stage in the film. So the contract. But you said I was going to grab tits. Well, there you go. You got Miriam Margulies.
Yeah.
I thought she was his mother.
No, she was just
his landlady.
Oh, yeah. See, Wendy, I know what you thought. It was his mother. Yeah.
We're not trudging into the trashy trio territory here. No, no. But she kept saying, you know, Alfie, you got to pay me all this money that you owe me. Like, I want the rent money right now. And he says, well, I don't have the money right now, but I can grab your tits. Okay.
Now, as I said, I don't think there was any song that I found memorable in the film. But in the one moment that I will concede was enjoyable in a trashy way was that song, Show Business.
Like a puppet on the string, like a monkey on a swing. Man is clinging to the ropes of the fantasies and hopes we are dangling. He's so eager to believe, and so easily deceived. Like a baby watching magic, he's so gullible, it's tragic in the word naive.
Life is nothing but show business in 1994. We hide all of the spotlight.
Even this, though, it's a moment of its it's fucking awful, but you still have to admire the excess a little bit. And this is my Federico Fellini moment. You know, you get the big jazz hands, the
right
the women who are marching in with those sequined, barely see-through tops, the circus entertainers, see the incredible shrinking man and the clown.
Was it the Ballet 2000?
That's the one I was. Yeah, that's the one I was telling you about. That's
right.
That reminded me of Jodorowsky completely. Like, I mean, something in the Holy Mountain. Like, just how it was kind of a spectacle. And it was ridiculous, and it just seemed like it was just overly done, and just, you know.
I was going to say that was the moment where you know, obviously, Mr. Boogaloo, he's going to break the fourth wall, because we in the audience are just not likely to get the fact that he's Satan, you see. So he's breaking the fourth wall to basically say, I am evil, and I take musicians and I rob them of their soul. They think they've got great art, but in fact, it is all just business. It is show business. I just love the fact that, you know, they gave us this fourth wall because we're not smart enough to work out what his modus operandi is.
How great it is to be a slave master song. What the fuck was that?
Yeah, that was the reggae one, wasn't it? That was just dreadful.
Yes.
Did you guys notice how funny it is how Mr. Boogaloo wears one earring, and then when they go to hell, he's only got one horn?
Yes, yeah.
he's got half a horn. It's like a fashion statement, you know, a fashion statement, right? You know, I don't know. I mean, like, to me, I mean, of course, you know, you get a lot of people that go after the hipsters and say, oh, yeah, you guys just love these films because they're so shitty. But to me, it's like, you know, I lived through the 70s and 80s. And now it's kind of like how, you know, we remember candy as kids. Like, there was that candy that, you know, we loved to eat as kids, but now if it as adults, we'd be like, oh my God, man, I can't believe I ate this. Like, as a child, I really liked this stuff. Like, ugh. You know, like Pixie Sticks and stuff like that, you know? And you just can't believe how at one time you found something really palatable, right? You know? And I think to me, that's kind of a way to kind of sum up this film is that I remember, you know, the whole disco craze and all the solid gold dancer era and all that shit. And I mean, when you look back at it and how everybody just, you know, tried to throw shit at a wall and hope that something would stick, you know, and that's what this film really is. But I mean, it's just so fun and it's goofy attempt. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not looking at this film like Citizen Kane, but it's just fun and how whacked out and they really thought they were onto something, and you know, they really thought that you know oh, this is really gonna groove with all the kids, you know. And meanwhile, it comes out and it's just like, I don't know who the hell you were pointing this film at, but you know, there's nobody there.
Well, actually, so one other thing I made a note about here is because we've spoken a bit about the songs, and you're sort of like alluding to this over here, Tim. I mean, who is the film aimed at, and who is the music aimed at? But it seems like every time that there's a film, and I'm talking about even films where I like the songs, like, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show and Phantom of the Paradise, which, you know, to me both have really great memorable tunes. But every time I see a film that says it's a rock and roll musical, the music often is so far away from the ideals of rock and roll.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's really funny too? It said that when I checked the credits, it said that the lyrics were written by George Clinton.
Yes,
he came in.
And yeah, that's what I checked. I went, whoa, wait a minute. No, man. George didn't write this. Tell me he didn't write this. Oh, thank God. Yeah.
No. And actually, when I was speaking before about Menachem Golan wanting to take the story and put it into English. And so he took the original creators of the show, Corby and Iris Recht, and he said, I'll put you in contact with someone who'll bring it into it, who'll help with the English. And it was Clinton. It was George Clinton. So, yeah, that was a name I'd forgotten. I can't believe.
He played Joe Pittman, the reporter in the film, the American sort of news guy, right, who shows up right at the start. And then he's serving drinks later. That's actually George Clinton who wrote the songs.
The guy that questioning.
Yeah.
Questioning everything.
Actually, so there's one question that I want to put to you, and maybe this was something to do with a missing scene. But we go from the start of the film where the idea is that BIM is the biggest music corporation in the world, but that's just what it is. It's a big music corporation. And as we get to the latter stage of the film where you get John Q. Law telling Miriam Margolyes and I think it might have been George Gilmore as well, why aren't you wearing your BIM mark? They've gone from being a big music corporation to being a totalitarian regime. They run the world. You know, it's 4 o'clock, everybody. Time for your BIM music.
Yeah, exercise.
There was no explanation. Where did it go from being a big music corporation to being the satanic corporation that is effectively it's running the world? What happened in the middle? And if that's the case, if why wasn't it the big corporation at the beginning? And if it was a big corporation at the beginning, why the hell does Satan need to win a pissy little competition that's like Eurovision? Oh, sorry, my mistake. World Vision.
You know, what's really funny is how, you know, it's actually George Clinton who says to Mr. Boogaloo, well, is it true that your song is going to be the soundtrack for the government exercise? And he's, you'll find out tomorrow. You'll find out tomorrow, you know. And that's all you hear about it.
Well, you do actually get to see the National BIM Hour later on when everybody stops to exercise to that piece of music.
So do you think that they've gotten word from the set of Can't Stop the Music that they were doing the milkshake? Because that's what it sort of reminds me of. Do the shake, do the milk, shake the milk. Oh, I can't. Did I sing that? No, sorry. Anyway,
we dreamt it. So, did anybody notice the vehicle designs here in the futuristic year of 1994? It's like an Italian post-apocalyptic film.
That's what I was gonna say, Bernie. It totally reminded me of Bronx Warriors or something, right? Like it just. Absolutely, right? Like,
If you're rich and famous in the year 1994 and a member of the BIM family, you don't travel around in Rolls Royces. You travel around in station wagons with bubbles on the roof.
Right. Or hearses with fins on them and
That's
stuff.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's so funny because, I mean, if you've ever seen the 1990 The Bronx Warriors, 1999, they actually, like, in the beginning – when Wendy was talking about the people with glitter on their faces and shit, it's so funny because the band that's playing with Alfie and Bim's band.
Pandy and Dandy.
They totally reminded me of one of the gangs in Bronx Warriors on roller skates, right?
Like
it's just hilarious. Like when you're watching this, you could tell, like, there's that total bleed over. Like, if you didn't know this was Golden Globus, you would swear this was done by Italians.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah,
big time.
Totally.
Big time.
So, Bernie, I think we've come far enough into the show that we can now do the spoiler alert, and you wanted to talk about that final scene in the film.
Well, basically, after all their trials and tribulations, Alfie and Bibi do finally get back together and live with a bunch of hippies in a park. Who just kind of show up out of nowhere at the end.
30 years after hippies.
That's right, yeah. They're still rejects from the 60s, living in the park.
Isn't that a funny thing? Mr. Tops introduces Alfie. He says, oh, these people here, they're what were called hippies.
But he's not Mr. Tops at that point. He's the leader of the hippies, isn't he?
Yes, you're right. So you're the leader of the hippies. And he made me think of Peter Ustinov. This is completely
Logan.
Exactly.
Yeah, I thought it was Peter Ustinov.
Totally. It was either Peter Ustinov or the big giant from the Muppet Show.
Sweetums. Sweetums.
Yeah, he just totally reminded me of the big giant from the Muppet Show. Yeah, Sweetums. Yeah.
Anyway, so, go on, Benny.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, they're living this idyllic hippie lifestyle, and then the man shows up to bust all the hippies, and Boogaloo and all his henchmen are there, and they want BB back because she owes them $10 million. She ran out on her contract, and then a freaking Cadillac pulls up out of the sky and some dude in a white suit comes down. What the hell? It's Mr. Tops, who
yeah,
Joss Ackland, in a white suit, and he basically just says, screw you, all you nasty people, all you hippies, come with me. And they walk off into the sky, and that's the end. It's like, what the fuck?
But I love how they don't say to him, we have contracts. They say, we have warrants. We have warrants.
Yeah.
You know? and it's, you know, and the one thing that bugs me is that if he's supposed to be God, it's like, you know, and he's driving up in a Cadillac, right? It's like, you know, they've been fighting capitalism tooth and nail, and the hippies are all going back to nature, and their savior rolls up in a fucking Cadillac.
In an expensive-looking three-piece white suit, yeah.
Right, and he comes trucking down, and he's just like, you know, Boogaloo, we don't need you anymore. You know, and he's like, wait a minute, you know, you can't have anything without me. You know, it's like, no, we're going to start again without you, you know. And it really makes me wonder whether or not they never show it, whether he just wipes everybody out. He wipes Earth out, wipes everything out. You don't know. It's like the end. You just see them trucking off and that's it.
I like to think in the sort of, you know, fan fiction that I'm going to be working on after we finish here today, that he leaves Earth in the hands of Mr. Boogaloo and just goes off and starts again. So you've got an evil corporate planet and then a wonderful, beautiful hippie planet as well.
So it becomes like the Death Star.
Yeah. But apparently, I'll read this bit sort of straight off of IMDb because it probably explains it better than I can. But the film originally began with a sequence in which Mr. Tops creates the world. He sings a song called Creation and brings various creatures, including Alfie, to life. Then he sings a song with Mr. Boogaloo, a.k.a. the Devil, who ultimately falls into a stream and disappears. Live animals, humans, puppets, and people in costumes filled a small set. Mishaps abounded as a tiger got loose, the elephants got their trunks stuck in the set pieces, people wearing a brontosaurus costume collapsed from the heat, and the terrain and restrictive size of the set proved difficult for the actors to dance through and cameras to manoeuvre. The omission of this disastrous shoot makes the biblical ending of the movie seem completely random. Yeah, that wow. just got that.
I don't know.
That
I just,
kind of
I
sums
just sort
up the
of,
film in a way, doesn't it?
So I think probably at this stage, final thoughts. Vendela, what can you tell us? Final thoughts.
Oh man.
Okay, that's a good start.
I have no final thoughts, folks. I think if you've heard us talk about this, that's all you need to know.
Right. So, any other final thoughts?
I was going to say I'd love to do, like, you know, a triple bill to show people, like, I would do something like maybe Yellow Submarine, Head, and the Apple. Just a complete mind warp. I mean, but you know, I just think that all three of them are very, you know, you have to kind of take them for what they're worth and take them on their own terms, right? I mean, like, you know, Yellow Submarine, if you don't like the Beatles, forget it. And, you know, with Head, it's just like, you know, you've got to follow the just experimental style that, you know, they were going at. I mean, with Rafelson and, you know, the whole way they went at it. And with the Apple, it's just, you know, you've got to take it for what it is. I mean, you know, you got to go in knowing, you know, it's total trash and it's total camp and the goofiness of it all. And it's just, you know, you just let the spectacle just ooze over you like the juice out of the bottom of a garbage bag, you know?
I'm all for so bad that it's good. But this kind of goes, you know, right through that and comes out the other side. And it's not just a car crash of a film. It's kind of like a slow motion car crash, which just seems to go on and on and just rubs all the horribleness in your face. And, you know, for like the first 10, 15 minutes, kind of like, yeah, this is really crap. Yeah. And then after that, it gets painful and then it starts hurting. And then, you know, Morris is having chest pains. And
I did.
Yeah, it's I really don't know if I can recommend this. I mean, it is the kind of thing that you need to see to believe. But at the same time, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Life's too short, isn't it? You know, and this is it's unique.
I guess if you're
unique.
Having a party, I guess, Bernie, if you're having a party over at Casa de Stickwell and the people aren't ready to leave,
you
could always throw on the apple.
Jeez. This will clear a room in like 30 seconds easily. Jesus. But yeah, right. I don't think I could honestly recommend it to people. I mean, if you hate yourself and you want to torture yourself, then
come
maybe
on.
But yeah, I'm honestly, right. I've seen it twice now, and I gave it the old college try, I gotta say, but it's fucking
brutal. But for people that think they've seen it all, and for everybody, you know, everyone has those friends, those frumpy, like, I've seen it. It's, yeah. Oh, but have you seen this? You drop that on them, and that'll shut them up real quick. You know?
Yeah. It's true, but, right. You know, shit stinks, and I don't think I need shit rubbed in my face for 90 minutes to know that shit stinks, you know?
I was thinking more like a shit sandwich, you know? You don't need to to smell.
With no bread.
With no bread to know that it's going to touch like shit.
See, that would be the two-word review, wouldn't it? Shit sandwich. My review for this would be just one word, and it would be shit.
I believe in elaborating, giving it a fair chance.
Really shit.
All right. Well, what we're going to do now is go to Mr. Justin Oberholzer, aka the Cinemasochist, and listen to what he has to say. And after you've heard that, we'll be back briefly to tell you what we're going to be doing in the next episode of See Here Podcast. We'll be back shortly. Here's the Cinemasochist.
Because the Cinemasochist Justin Oberholzer can't, unfortunately, make it onto today's show of the See Here Podcast to review the Apple, doesn't mean the Cinemasochist can't give his thoughts on this episode about the Apple. I may not be there with the crew themselves discussing the film today, unfortunately, due to a work and life in general kind of throwing curveballs my way, but I was able to squeeze in a viewing of the Apple and wanted to send my thoughts your way. Now, I know this one is regarded as, I guess, as a campy cult classic, as Netflix likes to promote it as, and for the most part, it's gotten its fair share of negative reviews. I know I've had a lot of people recommend it to me, some just on the face value alone of just genuinely enjoying the film, and a lot of others looking at it either in a so bad it's good way, or just thinking it's terrible, and thinking, well, that's the perfect film for the Cinemasochist. And while this definitely is a very good film for the Cinemasochist, it's actually good in the sense that I genuinely enjoyed The Apple. Not in a so bad it's good way, or that I'm laughing at it way, even though there are definitely moments where it gets a little bit too cheesy for its own good. But I, overall, quite enjoyed this film. Now, I'm not always the biggest fan of musicals, though I've noticed, I won't say softer, but they're starting to warm over me. But for this one, what I really liked about The Apple is what I can see a lot of people hating about it, and that is how gaudy it is. Yes, it's way too possibly overly gaudy at times, especially in the beginning when it's laying on thick, but the fact that the film just goes so over the top in its set decorations and its costuming is just so out there, especially for this, at the time, futuristic look at the year of 1994 and, 1979, 1980? I couldn't help but be won over by the film's charm. It does seemingly try so hard at times to really, like, essentially begging the audience to like it, but the begging worked, I guess. The story itself, with the two, the boyfriend and girlfriend duo being kind of swept up in Devilish would be a better word than CD, a devilish record-producing company, BIM, to be the next, like, pop sensation. That story holding the forbidden love and all that, it's rudimentary, it's basic, it does its trick. I wasn't overtly invested in that, but it was enough to get us from point A to point B. But what surrounds it, I just found was so much fun. I got a really good kick out of the way in which, you know, they decide who the next big act's going to be when they hold the talent contest, and they're judging by all the heartbeats, and you know, we had the typical rock band in the beginning getting 150 heartbeats, but then the duo who, you know, some people are against because, you know, it's nostalgia at that time. Love ballads are nostalgia, even though there actually is nice commentary about nostalgia being marketable and profitable. But that one's like, oh, they would never get over 150 heartbeats, and then they actually get to 151 and they have to sabotage it. Anyway, I don't want to ramble here. But, I mean, I like that stuff. I like the film's humor. I did love some of the set designs. Like, I really liked the sequence in which, and it's kind of a fantasy of Alfie, the male singer, when he visualizes signing the contracts with him as, you know, this is going to tie some to the title of the apple, as kind of Adam and Eve being tempted by the apple. So there's, you know, some religious undertones in there, but all just really fun. Now, as far as the songs go, only two really stuck out for me, and it kind of reminded me, actually, the film kind of reminded me a lot of Shock Treatment, which came out a year or two later, obviously the sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that I like Shock Treatment just like I like this film, but for me, Shock Treatment, its biggest weakness, surprisingly, was the fact that I just didn't think the musical numbers were that memorable. They were not bad whatsoever, and the songs were fine, but they weren't, they didn't capture my spirit or just really stick in my head like the songs from Rocky Horror Picture Show or personally my favorite musical and film that I feel deserves just as much, if not even more so, love, praise, adulation, and just mainstream success as the Rocky Horror Picture Show, that being Phantom of the Paradise. I watched that, I think, last year or 2 years ago, and I was just blown away. Absolutely love that. I think that's my kind of musical right there. But yeah, so, you know, Shock Treatment wasn't on those levels. And for the most part, I'd say the apple's kind of the same way as the Shock Treatment, as the songs themselves aren't as good and really aren't the strongest points of the film. Shock Treatment, the story with the public access channel and, you know, brainwashing the masses. This, you know, film using music, the apple, kind of using the same template and social commentary. But that was a lot more intriguing to me. And here, the story itself wasn't as intriguing as Shock Treatment, but just the set designs and just the nature of the film and its tone really was the selling point. But there were two songs in here that did stick out for me, one in particular that I almost kind of makes me appreciate this one. I like it a tad bit more than Shock Treatment. I know that's sacrilegious probably to say to many. The titular song, The Apple, which is the song that's played when, you know, he's having his visions of hell. That's good. That's really catchy. I liked it. And the other one that actually has stuck in my head and almost makes me want to get the soundtrack to the film just for this song alone, maybe I can find it on iTunes, is the America Speed song, how America just loves speed. Obviously, the joke in there with drugs. I just thought that was really catchy, very upbeat, very fun. And it helps because that one's the song that's set at an actual concert, so it feels more organic to the story. Though even then, you know, that sometimes is a trouble for me with musicals, but I kind of liked it in this case. Everything fit. Just even the really cheesy aspect of the film's like set designs, because not everything looks good. I got a kick out of how the cars look futuristic in 1994 when really they just look like the prototype of the Homermobile from when Homer Simpson created his own car in one of the early seasons of The Simpsons. And the names too are cheesy, like the film being Mr. Boogaloo, but, you know, so cheesy that I enjoyed them. But for me too, like the way that everybody dresses, especially some of Boogaloo's henchmen, very gaudy, just like very like silver glitter makeup, almost look like neon took a crap and that's what came out. What it actually made me think of is whenever we watch, especially sometimes with comedies, certain science fiction films and cartoons and such, when we look at other alien life forms and specifically look at how like life would be on another planet, it's always this futuristic, drenched in neon, very cartoonish, like over the top look, because that's how we would like to either see the future and or other alien life forms. And all I could think about, especially in the beginning of this film when its style is really being laid on thick and you're just drowning in it, is how this must be what alien life forms, if they did exist, viewed Earth and its inhabitants, us humans, as. And to the point where I thought, well, maybe this was a film that was made on Mars or something like that. Okay, this is what we think the world's going to be like in 1994 on Earth. This is what Earth is like. We know it. And somehow, Canon Films just got a hold of this film, and instead of promoting it as this alien film, and just as such. I don't know, I just kind of got a kick out of it because it's, I always like that about films, and especially because there's two ways if you're going to do a movie set in the future. You either do the like post-apocalyptic look or just kind of – or going that way. Like I just watched 12 Monkeys for the first time a few weeks ago and really enjoyed it. And that one, no, not too far into the future at the time of its release, did kind of view the future as being grim, getting into the way of like post-apocalypse, such as a Mad Max type world. Well, maybe not so much for 12 Monkeys. But you either do that or you do what the Apple does, and you just view the future as this just gaudy, neon, digital tech wonder world, which we're kind of at. We're just not as gaudy. And I always get a kick out of that, because if you're going to look into the future, you're going to do this, go big or go home. Because I always thought, well, why wouldn't, you know, you look into the future and kind of look at it modestly? And while that's fine, if you're going to do a film set in the future, and especially if you're going to do a film like The Apple, where it's inherently just supposed to be cheesy and fun, why not, you know, go big or go home? And for some of this film's faults, yes, it does try way too hard at times to really get you to like it. And, you know, like I said, the story itself, it's middle of the road. And the songs, you know, none of the songs are bad, but only two really stuck out for me. But, I mean, it is just, for me, I just thought this was so much fun. And I wouldn't say I'm in the love camp, but I am definitely in a genuinely enjoying this camp. And I will defend this film till the day I die. And it's not going to be with my tongue firmly planted in cheek, because I don't feel this is a bad film that is good. I would almost, in a weird connection, I would defend this like I would defend Miami Connection, in that I'm not enjoying this for the wrong reasons, in the sense that I'm laughing at the film like somebody would maybe enjoy The Room. I'm enjoying this film because I just genuinely think it's good. Now, in this case of The Apple, it's clear that the filmmakers knew this was going to be campy. They're not really taking this serious. As to where with Miami Connection, maybe the filmmakers knew a bit that they were trying to have some fun, but I mean, they took that seriously. But it's the charm of both of these films and of the filmmakers, and just the heart and soul put in these, that really just won me over. And again, I'm rambling now. So, I mean, and the film is very obvious at times, too. I have a note, one of the songs, the big lyric is, "I'm coming for you," and I'm like, yeah, well, obvious joke is obvious. But I'm not going to – this was fun. This was a very good treat, and it is still a Netflix Instant, folks. I didn't think it was, because I thought I went searching for it the other day, and I couldn't find it on Netflix Instant. So I was looking this morning to see, because I think Amazon Instant also has it, which I don't have, but I was thinking of signing up for, possibly. But I was looking, hey, maybe, you know, one of the channels on my Roku would have it. So when I was searching through Roku, it said, well, watch instantly on Netflix. And I was like, I thought it went off. So apparently it's still on Netflix, and it was still in my instant queue. I just somehow skipped over it. Or when I searched it the other day, it wasn't coming up. Unless it just miraculously popped up the day I wanted to watch it. So I would even, well, if you're not a fan of musicals, it might be a little hard-pressed. Obviously, I'm going to say, if you're a fan of something like Rocky Horror Picture Show, Shock Treatment, I'd say Phantom of the Paradise, but I think that's the one musical that transcends even people that hate musicals, because rightfully so, a lot of people love that film. But yeah, we're going to say something like a Shock Treatment or just that kind of musical. This is definitely right up your alley. I enjoy this a lot more than I thought. I really thought that I might like bits and pieces of it, but overall the package wouldn't work. But I had fun with it. For me, my rating scale, I'd give it a B. I thought this was solid and really enjoyable. And again, I apologize to everybody that I couldn't be on the show, except in this format. But hopefully in the future we can get something worked out and get the schedulings down. Just it wasn't to be this time, which is a shame, because this would have been a fantastic film to talk about with a group of people. And I can't wait to listen to this review and probably skip over this feedback, because I don't like hearing the sound of my own voice. All right, thanks, guys. Have a great day.
And we're back from break. Thank you, Justin, for your review. And yeah, so Justin tended to go very much in Tim's line of thought. He really enjoyed it, and not at all ironically. So, yeah, good on you, Cinemasochist. We look forward to having you on the show. But next time, I think we're going to sort of go against the grain, and when you're available, we're going to pick a good film. So something that, you know, may challenge your masochist tendencies, but, you know, but we'd love to have you on.
That boy ain't right, is he?
Oh, no, he's right. He watches the films so you don't have to.
Yeah.
He's a good lad. He's
Thank
a good lad.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you.
So it's now time to talk very briefly about episode 19 of See Here podcast coming up next month. And we're very, very excited here at See Here headquarters, because we are going to have definitely one special guest, possibly two, but I don't want to reveal who they are just yet. Keep a look on the Facebook pages, but trust me, it's going to be worth it. What I will reveal is the movie under discussion, and this is a film which I believe, Wendy, you only saw for the first time, I think, was it last year? And you put up a post saying...
Yeah, last year. I'm so glad I did.
You put up a post saying, I never would have believed that this film was going to be like this. And you probably had one picture of it, being one way, and it was something completely different. And the film, of course, is, I think, from 1978, Bob Fosse's All That Jazz. Yeah, this film is I think when I was 13 or 14. So it's been with me a long time, and I'm dying to know what you guys have to say about it, and certainly very interested to know what our definite one, possibly two special guests are going to have to say about it. But anyway, that's for next month. Bob Fosse starring Roy Scheider. We'll discuss more about that next month, but it was a big step for Roy Scheider, who'd done so many great crime action films in the 70s, and this was a definite out of his comfort zone film. So if you haven't gone and seen All That Jazz yet, I don't know if this is on Netflix or not. It'll probably be on Hulu, I imagine, because they manage the Criterion films, and this has come out as a Criterion edition. So if you haven't seen it, I urge you to do so. And if you have seen it, watch it again. We've got a lot to say about it next month, no doubt. So I think that is it. Everyone, it's been, despite the fact that we, three of us didn't like it and one of us did, but it was still a very fun conversation about the Apple. So,
interject here, Morris? Yeah. It looks like All That Jazz is actually on YouTube in full as well. So.
Really?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah. In fact, okay, I'll post the link on the Facebook group. So.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, so there you go, folks. No excuses. Follow along with us. And if you have any feedback, please send an email to seehearpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Or even if you have some thoughts that you want to post on the Facebook page about the film, we'll read them out, because I really would like to know what you as a community think about this film. It's one that I hold near to my heart, so I'm giving the game away a little bit there, but we'll still have plenty to say, no doubt. So until next month, be nice to each other, watch some good movies, and watch some shit-ass films if you feel like hurting yourself. But just basically be nice to each other, and rip that BIM sticker off your forehead. That's it from me.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Power by the hour.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.